Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches. Hello and welcome to Access Utah. I'm your host, Brian Earl, and Diane Alston, USU's Extension USU Extension entomologist, who happens to know a lot about vegetables, is my guest for the entire hour. So if you'd like to join our conversation, the toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. You can also email us at upraccess@gmail.com or tweet us your question at AU Garden. So just look for us on Twitter, and I hope you'll follow the program as well. I'll send out tips once or twice a week that kind of give you some ideas of what to do. I think last week I talked about how to pick a ripe watermelon. Sometime this week I'll send something out about when to plant your garlic, which is kind of right now. So follow us on Twitter at hashtag AU_garden. I'm still getting used to this.
Yeah, there's lots of little things you got to remember in the address.
Well, Diane, there's still plenty that can be done with insects. I've heard a lot from people about wasp stings. They keep calling them bee stings.
Yes.
So I'm like, they're not bees. They're wasps.
That's right.
But why is it that a honeybee sting doesn't sting nearly as much as, say, something from a hornet or from a wasp? Why are those so much more hot?
There's different levels of venom that are injected. Now, with the honeybee, what happens is if you can feel any... of course, no one wants to be stung, but if you can feel any of that sense of revenge, is that the honeybee that stung you does die because it has a barb on its stinger. And so when it's stuck into you, it actually pulls it out of its body and it will kill that honeybee. So one thing is you can continue to get, if the venom sac comes out of the bee and gets stuck on the stinger that remains in your skin, you can continue to pump in venom for a period of time. But the ouch level of honeybee venom is not as high as compared to most hornets and then also to the yellow jacket. Yeah. The European paper wasp has, its ouch level is less than that of the yellow jacket hornet group. It is... I've heard people say various things, more in line with the honeybee. Some people think it hurts a little more. Some people think it hurts a little less. So you do get, a range of, and it depends on how much venom is injected. But with the hornet wasp group, they don't have a barbed stinger. And so they don't die from stinging you one time.
So they have plenty left, and that would also explain why sometimes you get stung two or three times by the same insect.
Right, they can sting multiple times. However, generally what's going to happen is the amount of venom they have in their little venom sac that's attached to their stinger is going to go down over time. So probably the first sting is going to inject the most venom, and then it's going to be less in subsequent stings. But, sometimes they can be caught off surprise and not inject as much the first time and inject more the second time. It's, so it can vary. There's a lot of factors. And, of course, just individual humans, too. Some people are much more sensitive, have more of a response to the venom than others.
And yellow jackets and hornets, it seems to me, are also a little bit more maneuverable and quicker. But maybe that's just me noticing them a lot more so.
Well, and I guess you have to think about it in an evolutionary sense. The honeybee, I mean, she doesn't know in her mind that, if I sting, I'm going to die. But it's kind of a last ditch effort to protect the colony, protect the hive. And so it's not something that they necessarily, they do it as a protection for the hive, but they don't, they might not be as quick to sting as maybe a bee or, as a wasp or hornet.
Now, populations for the European paper wasp they were a little bit more this year, although I've seen them taper off. I'm also seeing still nests that start getting built and then they just kind of die out.
They abandon them. Yeah. They don't complete them. Yeah. They were in general pretty numerous this year. They started relatively slow in terms of buildup, which surprised me a little bit because given the very warm summer we had from beginning to end, I expected them to be worse early on. And so when they weren't, I thought, well, maybe it's not going to be a bad year. But then lo and behold, it did turn out that there were a lot of them later in the summer. And this time of the season, they're very focused, the European paper wasps, on eating fruit. They're attracted to that ripe fruit, to the sugar that they get from the ripe fruit. Also, you'll see them hanging around water. So if you've got a pond, an ornamental pond, or a water bucket, or even just a leaky faucet, those are the places that you're going to see these guys hang out.
Now, over time, how much pulp are they collecting from wood? I have this wooden, I guess, a jungle gym outside that's been there for quite a while, and I sure see a lot of those wasps.
Yeah. That's an ideal kind of pulp for them to make their nests from. So, yeah, they certainly will chew on that. Any kind of wood, maybe even some kinds of paper, insulation, things like that, that they can bite pieces off and macerate up and then build their nest with. But this time of year, they're not, probably why you've seen them taper off in terms of the nest building or abandoning nests, is that they're, with the day length shortening, they're not laying any more eggs, or that's really slowing down. They overwinter in the adult stage, and so they just seek out protected places to spend the winter, in outbuildings, under the eaves, places like cracks and crevices that they can tuck themselves into. And so they're more focused now on building up their food. The adults that are out are focused on building up their food reserves, their energy, so that they can survive the winter. And they've turned to that versus producing offspring.
Now, as far as the bald-faced hornet, is that the largest hornet that we have in
Utah? The largest one that we have here, yes.
Okay. I see abandoned nests with them, and it seems like they get the whole nest build up, and then they're gone. What seems to be any problems with them?
Not that I'm aware of. It may be that there are certain factors that came to play that they decided that this wasn't the suitable spot for a nest. But generally, after they've invested that much effort in building a nest, it's unlikely for them to abandon it. They do not overwinter in that nest. So maybe you're just seeing old nests that were built that year and used, and then now they're finished with them.
We used one of those nests in an object lesson at church yesterday, and there, I still have this reaction when the other teacher brought out the nest. It just got run.
Right. There could be hornets in there.
But it's such a beautiful nest.
It is.
Just looking on the outside and the different colors in the paper, is that just the different kind of wood that they happen to be making it with?
Different sources that they have used over time gives it that pattern or those kind of striping appearance, yeah.
So the nest on the inside, I didn't open it up. How compartmentalized is it on the inside?
Yeah, it has cells in it, pretty similar to the open nest that you see the European paper wasp, with individual cells where they lay the egg in and then provision the young, so they have food while they develop inside. So yeah, pretty similar. It's if you cut one open, it's packed with all those little cells.
So these insects are quite beneficial for us. The bald-faced hornet, I remember you telling me that they love to eat flies.
Yeah, they do have a beneficial side, and it's hard for people to fully embrace, given that they're concerned about the stings they can deliver. My feeling is for any of these wasps, hornets, because they are predators on other insects and help with garden pest control, if they have a nest in an area that's not causing a nuisance to you, then I would say let it be. Now, the European paper wasp.
That was a joke, right?
Yeah.
Let it be?
Let it be.
Okay.
I think that's especially true for the hornet. They often build their nests high up in trees, and they're not... Often they're not near, your doorway or things like that. So usually, a lot of times people don't even know they're there. And so I think that's fine. The European paper wasp is a little different in that it does like that ripe fruit so much that if you are trying to grow fruit in your garden, it can be a pest later on.
Sure, and so like raspberries.
They do. So I'd say some nest management there can be helpful.
And they also tend to like to build much closer to where you are versus those hornets.
They do. They tend to be very well suited to urbanization.
Now, what about bumblebees? I haven't seen them for in the spring. Mm-hmm. I saw a good number of them. Have they already gotten what they need and now they're...
And you don't see as many this time of year? I think that's partially true. I mean, I still see a few around, but their populations peak early on when there's more flowers available. And so their food sources are a little different, certainly, than the wasps. And so their populations are more in line with that flowering cycle. I took a hike up to Mount Naomi over the Labor Day weekend, and I saw some bumblebees up there on some of the flowers that were still out. So, I mean, there are still some around, but certainly not as many as early on.
What, and this is maybe out of your area of expertise, but what flowers tend to be the ones that attract the beneficial pollinating insects?
Well, in general, flowers that there are certain colors that some that bees like. So we've heard about the blues and the purples and yellows tend to be best for bees versus like red for hummingbirds. But beyond that, and the flower shape can have an effect, it's flowers that produce what we would consider a lot of good quality nectar and pollen. And so these do tend to be plants that are wildflowers. A lot of the flowering herbs, if you let the herbs go to flower, those are very attractive.
That I have noticed. I've got herbs on the back porch that I have let flower, and there are just bees all over in them.
Right. So like if you grow cilantro, but you let it go to flower with the coriander, we call it, when it's in bloom, that's very attractive to pollinators as well as to beneficial insects, some of the predatory insects and parasitic wasps. So those are the flowers that you want to make sure you have available diversity around your landscape and garden. The flowers that have been highly selected, such as a petunia, or the cultivated geraniums, those really have very little nectar in them, and so they're not going to be feeding this pollinator population. I'm not saying don't grow those, but make sure you also plant other things that can provide that good quality food source.
I know bumblebees, when growing up, I remember them going after snapdragons.
Right.
And popping them open, and snapdragons actually come back if it's a fairly mild winter, and some of them recede. So
right,
penstemons.
Right, those are all those are all good. And so some flowers too are designed to have kind of traps for not traps to keep them in, but so when they enter the flower, that they definitely pick up a lot of pollen, and so they rub it off on the bee, whether it's collecting it on its underside or whether it's collecting it onto some structures on its legs, hind legs. But they pick up more than if they don't have those little sections they have to crawl through to access tight spaces.
I love nature and how it's developed such specialties for keeping for doing just that.
Right.
I can't remember. I was listening to a PBS documentary a while back, and it talked about this one plant and how bees get trapped inside of it, and they basically have to fly around inside of it to find their way out. But in the process of doing so, they collect a lot of pollen.
Well, and it's known for even like fruit tree flowers, like apple, for example, that the blue orchard bee is a better pollinator than even is the honeybee. And the reason is that the honeybee is a fairly large, relatively large bee in comparison to the flower size. And it can sit on the flower petal and reach in and quickly get a treat of nectar if it's not interested in collecting pollen at that time, because they tend to be kind of on certain kinds of trips when they're out foraging. They're collecting nectar or they're collecting pollen. And so if a honeybee's focused on collecting nectar, they can sit on the edge and basically we call rob the flower of its nectar without either transferring or collecting any pollen and then move off quickly to another flower. Whereas the blue orchard bee is a smaller bee. It does have to climb more into that flower center part, and in the process will either transfer or collect pollen in the process. So in general, they're a little more efficient pollinator than is honeybee.
Okay. Well, we'd like to have your questions or comments. The toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. 800-826-1495. You can email us your question at uprxcess@gmail.com or tweet us your question, #AUGarden. And our first caller is Linda in North Logan. Hi, Linda. How can we help?
Hi. Well, good morning. I just noticed I have box elder bugs all over a lilac bush, and it looks like they are damaging the leaves. Is there anything I ought to do about it?
So when you say that it looks like they're damaging the leaves, what symptoms do you observe?
It's just they have black spots all over them, and, you know, they just don't look healthy.
Well, I suspect that the lilac leaves may be suffering from something else besides the box elder bugs. It is true that we're seeing large congregations of them right now on all kinds of woody plants. But those are the adults, and the black spots could be their excrement, their poop. That's not harming the leaf. That would wash off. But they're just congregating there in clusters and looking for places to hide for the winter as the days cool off and the days shorten. And so I doubt that they're actually feeding on the leaves of the lilac itself.
Well, all right, good. I just let them do their thing then.
Well, one comment is if you do have issues with them coming into your house over the winter or congregating the outside of your house, you can target some treatment of them on these places where they're congregating now. And using a soapy water solution, and if you want to add in something like the Pyganic, which is a permethrin-type product, you can help reduce the numbers around your landscape at this time if that's an issue for you. If it's not, if you don't have an issue with that, then I wouldn't worry about it.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks,
You're
Linda.
Welcome.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Are you seeing any continued damage from weevils? On the
lilacs. So I was talking with our retired plant pathologist, Sherm Thompson, earlier this summer, and he was mentioning that his lilacs are just not looking very good. And we talked about it some more and about the root weevils that do feed on the lilac. And he said, yeah, I have some of that. But he said, this just seems like it's something more. And so we were wondering if maybe there's some kind of a disease that's attacking the lilac, and maybe that's what, including Linda's noticing, where they just don't look very good.
Well,
something
and
else
with,
going on.
Usually, lilacs are pretty hardy. I know you see a lot of abandoned homesteads, mm-hmm. and there's still a lilac bush
right.
outside, so you wouldn't think it would be too much drought stress.
Right.
So I hope there's not a disease.
And I've also seen lilacs with just very heavy root weevil feeding, and the root weevil feeding is the notching around the edges of the leaves. But also the larvae are feeding on the roots, and so it can stunt or cause some decline in the lilac when you do get very high populations of the lilac root weevil. But I've seen lilacs with lots of root weevil. And, you know, granted, they don't maybe look as healthy as if they didn't have it, but they seem to just keep plugging along and doesn't cause them mortality. And so, again, I think that in talking with Dr. Thompson, we suspect that maybe there's some kind of a disease that may be attacking lilacs. And I don't know what it is. And it's also a little unusual to think a hot, dry year is a year where we're going to have more issue with that. But that may be happening. So we'll be looking into it more and see if we can figure out what's going on.
If you see a lot of notching in the leaves, is that usually the root weevil?
That's the root weevil, yes.
Okay. Our next caller is from Teasdale. We have Brian. Hi, Brian. How can we help?
I'm at 7,000 feet, and I have an organic vegetable garden and quite a few plants alongside of it. And I have a very healthy bee population, one of which I assume is my cutter bees. And they are trying to destroy my blaze rose. They decimated one of my transplanted aspen trees. Anything in particular that I can do for those guys to keep them from damaging?
So when you say that they're devastating your blaze orange, are you seeing the round-shaped cuttings out of the edges of the leaves?
Yes.
And are they quite circular, versus just an irregular notch on the edge?
Yes.
Okay. Well, it is true that they are harvesting leaf material to make their nests. And so that can be, if it's a desirable plant in your landscape, that can be a concern. In terms of what you can do, you can use a contact insecticide that's going to repel the bees from collecting on those plants. You don't want to spray it at the time when they are in bloom, because you don't want to be harming bees that are coming to feed on the flowers. But if you can just get it on the foliage, that can be used as a deterrent to them for collecting the leaf pieces.
Where he's got an organic garden, is there something he can spray on there, like
Pyganic?
Okay.
Yeah, I'd say Pyganic would be what comes to mind. You could also even just try some soap, either insecticidal soap or making your own soap solution, and that may provide some deterrent as well. But I'd certainly think something like the pyrethrin that's in Pyganic would be a deterrent, but I wouldn't apply it again at the time when it's in bloom. See if you can just kind of direct it on the foliage and the areas that you're having the most problem.
All righty. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for your call.
Yeah, that's difficult when you've got to, you don't want to harm the beneficials, but they're not treating your plant so well.
Well, good luck
to you. Well, they wake me up in the morning on my Russian sage. They're wonderful.
Yes. So you certainly want to encourage them, just discourage them from using leaf pieces off of certain plants.
Great. Thanks for your call.
Thanks again. Bye-bye.
I was also thinking about, and I can't think of the name of the chemical from peppers.
Oh, capsaicin.
A capsaicin.
Yeah, so that would also be a deterrent as well. Yeah.
So anything with capsaicin in it, you could just spray on the leaves, and so they'd fly to it and go, yeah, I don't like this, and then fly off. Is that how
it
works?
That's basically what you're wanting to, is a repellent versus something that's going to harm them.
And since you're not actually eating the roses, unless you use the hips, then that works pretty well.
Yep.
I'm just wondering now, right now, I've been seeing a lot of hobo spiders coming into the house.
Yes, this is the time of year.
And I can always tell the hobo spiders because I'll be watching TV and all of a sudden I see really fast across the carpet. So I usually get the remote control and whap, whap a couple of times, because I usually let insects go even in the house unless they start building up populations or something. But hobos, I don't.
Yeah, and I can understand. In general, most people don't want too many spiders inside their home. They're okay with the ones that are hanging up under the eaves, helping with the fly and mosquito control. But inside on your, on your carpet in your home is not as desirable.
But even the other spiders, I kind of let them go. There's not usually too many of them, but the hobo, I've just seen damage from what they do. So
yeah, so it's a little concerning. Certainly, the standard recommendations or the ways to manage spiders, the first thing is to try to prevent them from coming in as best as you can. So things that you can do are make sure that your doors and window casings are well sealed, so putting some weather stripping around those to help keep them tightly closed so that they don't get in. That's the very most important first step.
Can they sense where the heat is coming out of the house and that's where they go for?
Yeah, they probably could. But I think more of anything, it's just they get down. They're mainly a problem in basements and on first floors. They don't tend to climb on smooth surfaces well, or they don't climb on smooth surfaces well. So you don't tend to see them upstairs as much. So it's more just a matter of exploring and finding cracks and crevices that they can get into. So making sure that you don't have cracks in your foundations, or if you do, to seal those up. Those kinds of things come first. Exclude them from coming in. That's the most important first step. Also, we know that a lot of heavy shrubbery, a lot of people have mulch around their foundation, which I think some is fine, but if you've got a big buildup of heavy vegetation or dead vegetation, that can be prime habitat for them, and having that right next to doorways and windows that are in that basement level can create more of a spider problem inside. So again, exclusion first thing. Then after that, you can purchase these sticky spider traps, sticky boards that are very effective at catching spiders, and place those in hot spots. So places that are near doorways or window wells, especially behind furniture, you know, along your baseboards, places where the spiders are going to spend their time, behind the door jamb, so where the door opens back behind in that little corner back there. Those are all prime habitat for hobo spiders and other spiders. So put your traps there. You can use them to monitor to see what you're getting, but they also are a control as well.
And they work pretty good, those
they
sticky
do.
Traps.
So those are, I'd say, the most important steps. And then people always ask about, well, I'd like to spray something. In general, I would advise trying to direct your sprays more outside than inside. If you really get to that point where you feel like you've got to use an insecticide, be aware that spiders do walk up on their claws, so they don't have a lot of contact with the surface as they're moving. And so the most effective sprays are going to be things that contact them directly or get a residue on a habitat where they are. So spraying that foundation and outer, you know, those that shrubbery and things around the base of the house is going to be likely to be more effective than spraying indoors. Plus, you're exposing you and your family to pesticide residues when you spray indoors. I know that from experience that firewood piles, they love, you know, you can find lots of hobos in those. So don't have your firewood stack right next to the door of your basement, that kind of thing. All those things can help reduce the numbers.
Now, did I read somewhere that their bite does not cause as much damage as was originally thought?
I think that it's out for debate.
No, okay.
And the problem is that most people don't see what bites them. And so to follow it through and say, a hobo spider bit me, and this is the symptoms that I developed, there's just very little medical evidence for that. People often that do have some kind of a bite, they don't know for sure that it was a hobo spider that bit them. And so it's hard to know. So right now, the most recent literature in both the entomological and medical literature is suggesting that in most cases, there are not a large amount of what we call necrosis, where you get that death of skin or tissue around a spider bite. You know, I hesitate to say that it cannot happen because we don't know that for a fact. But I think people are maybe overly frightened or concerned about hobo spiders. And I think we need to be a little more realistic and factual and say that, yes, they can deliver a bite. And there may be some individuals that have a very strong response to it. It's going to vary with the sex of the spider. Males tend to inject more venom than a female. The time of their age, whether they're a young or an older spider, the individual, how much venom is injected. Lots of factors can, I think, play a role in the seriousness of any kind of spider bite. And so, you know, certainly be cautious. The main bites that do happen come from them being in like clothing or something like that, where you put a shirt on that has a spider in it and, you know, and it's pinched between the clothing and the skin and it bites in a self-defense. Generally, hobos are not, even though they run fast, they do run very fast, they're not aggressive in the sense of they're going to come after you and try to bite you. They're running to escape. So,
escape what?
They're afraid of this huge, large, looming, dark figure they see.
So, if a chicken or another bird would eat them, would they then ingest the venom? And
yeah,
have
they
problems,
would.
Or?
I've not heard of that being a concern. Yeah. So, again, I'm not saying that they don't ever cause a bite that might cause a concern, but I think it's been inflated as to how damaging their bites can be. So we just need to be cautious, but not overly so. Don't freak out, in other words.
And as I had to tell someone the other day with an insistence, we do not have certain spiders in our area.
The brown recluse
does not live in Utah, other than if it comes in on something else, then it dies fairly soon after it arrives.
Right. So at this point in time, when people ask me what's the most damaging the spider that has the worst venom that occurs in Utah. I'm saying the black widow. That's the one that we know can cause that necrosis, that tissue death and sloughing, you know, where it really takes some medical care to deal with it and try to prevent any kind of long-term scarring. The hobo may in some cases, but it doesn't seem very prone to bite. As many hobos as I know lived in my house in River Heights and all those years, and to my knowledge, none of us were ever bitten. I feel from personal experience that the chances of being bitten by a hobo are pretty low.
And they don't build, they're not an orb type spider. No. They're building more of a funnel. You see,
right, it's a funnel web.
Webbing all together that kind of goes into this little hole.
Right. So that's the kind of web that they build. So, but why you're seeing so many this time of year, in the fall, the males do go in search of females for mating. And so you're mostly seeing males, not only exclusively, but a lot of the ones that you see out roaming around are the males. And they can run very quickly up to like 40 inches per second, so that's pretty fast.
That's pretty fast.
Yeah.
And my cat loves to chase them. So,
yeah. So I'd say let your cats have them.
Well, we're have approached the halfway point of our program. We're going to listen to the latest edition of Wild About Utah, and then we'll be back with Diane Alston until the top of the hour, so stay tuned.
Welcome to Wild About Utah, a partnership of the Stokes Nature Center, the Bridgerland Audubon Society, and Utah Public Radio.
This is Linda Kirvin for Bridgerland Audubon Society. Now, in late summer, the sunny golden blooms of sunflowers adorn gardens, roadsides, and wild places across much of the United States. Utah is home to 5 sunflower species, 4 of them annuals. You are most likely to see Helianthus annuus, the aptly named common sunflower. Early domestication of common sunflower by Plains Indians led to the major oilseed crop that the world enjoys today. Humans are not the only species seeded at the sunflower dining table, however. The grub of one specialist weevil bores in sunflower stalks, as do larvae of 2 longhorn beetles. Another weevil hollows out the seeds. A third decapitates the flower head before ovipositing. One moth's caterpillar gnaws the roots. Several cutworm species topple seedling sunflowers, and several more kinds of butterfly caterpillars skeletonize sunflower leaves. In your garden, though, sunflowers generally escape pestilence. Chickadees and both American and lesser goldfinches cling to the ripe seed heads to pluck out the nutritious seeds. Listen for the plaintive call of the lesser goldfinch, which is very distinctive. All those sunflower seeds are the direct result of pollination by bees. In the American West, more than 200 species of native bees visit sunflowers for nectar or pollen, a remarkably large fauna for any flower. None is more charming than the male of the bee genus Melisodes. They are discernible for their extra-long antennae. Melisodes males dart among sunflowers all day long, seeking willing mates. Come sunset, the males bed down on the flower heads to snooze. They become drowsy enough to pet with your fingertip, and being males, have no sting. So if you have sunflowers at hand, chances are you have Melisodes bees around too. Look over your sunflowers this evening, and you may be lucky enough to find those dozing bachelor bees with their extra-long antennae. This is Linda Kirvin for Bridgerland Audubon Society.
Wild About Utah is a partnership of the Stokes Nature Center, the Bridgerland Audubon Society, and Utah Public Radio. For transcripts and archived audio of Wild About Utah, go online to upr.org and click on the Wild About Utah link. Support for Wild About Utah comes from the College of Natural Resources at Utah State University. Information is at cnr.usu.edu.
Support for Utah Public Radio is provided by the Cache Valley Center for the Arts, celebrating 20 years this season with Body Vox combining dance, theater, and film September 28th at 7:30. Ticket information is at elleneccles.org.
Welcome Welcome back to the second part of Access Utah today. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in studio with me is Diane Alston. She's USU's extension entomologist, and we're talking about insects. Call with your questions at 1-800-826-1495. Send us an email question at upraccess@gmail.com. Or you can tweet us your question at hashtag AUGarden. So
Lots of ways to reach us.
I did want to give our gardening calendar because it seems like I always wait till the end and then I never have any time. So on October 2nd from 5:30 to 8:30 p.m., Harmon City Creek and Wasatch Community Gardens are offering a class on pressure canning and how to preserve your own meats. Pre-registration is required. For registration and more information, go to Wasatch Community Gardens event page online. Starting tomorrow, 2 p.m. till 4:30 p.m., Thanksgiving Point will offer a class on fall pruning and bringing fall colors into the garden. The cost is $36 for members and $40 for the general public. To enroll, visit thanksgivingpoint.org. And then this Saturday from 8 until noon, the USU Botanical Center is having a fall garden fair where you can learn about a large variety of ornamental grasses. There is no cost, and more information is at usubotanicalcenter.org. Okay, Diane, in the 18 minutes or so that we have left, we probably should talk about spider mites, and you have down rust mites.
Yeah,
I don't think I've ever
rust
seen
blister
rust
mites as well. Well, they're all mites, but they're different kinds. So let's start with spider mites, which are the most common group of mites that we have problems with in our gardens and landscapes. And the two-spotted spider mite in particular is the one that tends to be the most abundant. They like hot, dry weather, which we had a lot of this summer. And so we've been seeing issues with them throughout the summer. But recently, we've been having some calls and inquiries come in about, you know, even late, pretty late season mites starting to build up. And so the symptoms that you tend to see are the plants start to look kind of dirty because the mites produce webbing and dirt, debris sticks in that. So the plants take on kind of a dirty look. Also, they take on, they lose their color. So instead of seeing being nice, you know, vibrant green, the mites suck the sap out of the leaves in little tiny spots. So they kind of look like this white stippled or speckled appearance. And then if it becomes severe enough, they can even take on a bronzing kind of a appearance. And the plants don't look as vigorous, obviously. And the mites can even feed directly on the fruits on the plant. So your beans, your tomatoes, your peppers, the mites can even start to feed on the surface of those fruits if there's enough of them. A good way to diagnose them, if you're not sure, take a piece of white paper or anything light in color, vigorously shake the leaves over that, and if you see little things drop that then start to crawl around, if you have a hand lens or magnifying lens, you can look and you can see that indeed they are mites. So what to do? For the home gardener, there's some really neat ways to stay on top of mites. Once you get into a problem where the plant is just totally enclosed in webbing, it's a little late in the game. You may not be able to save that plant, and you may just be better off to pull it up. But if you catch it when it's still starting to build, taking a nozzle on your hose delivers a stiff spray, and just washing down that plant every 2 to 3 days for a week, maybe even a week and a half to 2 weeks if necessary, that's a great way to really reduce spider mites. They don't like the moisture. You're washing the mites off the plant. Many of those will die, not be able to get back on the plant. But you have to do it for a period of time because they do lay a lot of eggs, and those eggs are going to be hatching, so you have to keep washing that plant down. Also, insecticidal soap and horticultural mineral oil are also very effective against spider mites. But again, best to start when you first start to see the symptoms. Don't wait until you have an all-out outbreak. And they have a very broad host range, fruit trees, raspberries. And raspberries in particular, so you see this browning, bronzing of the foliage low on the raspberry canes, and then over time it moves up. Your vegetables, a lot of your ornamentals, both annuals and perennials, they all get spider mites. So be on the lookout for those and take steps to prevent them from damaging the plant too much before, especially for perennials, things that are going to need to go into the winter in a good health. Now, the rust and blister mites are a different group of mites. We call those aerophyids, and they're little teeny tiny mites. You really need pretty high magnification, 30 times or higher, to see them very well. And they're more of a little worm-shaped mite, a little wedge shape. Their head end is broader than their tail end. And they overwinter in the buds of fruit trees, perennial plants, woody plants. And then they come out in the spring and feed on the new growth, and like on the apple and pear, you see these little blisters on the leaves, these little pustules or places where they cause damage, and then they live inside of those blisters over the summer and feed, and they start off just being green in color, the same as the leaf, but look like they're little crinkled bumps, and then later in the summer they turn brown. And then in the fall, they go back into the buds as adults to overwinter. And so the two key times to manage these are in the fall and the spring. But it's not your typical pesticides, insecticides that work on them. That you need something with a sulfur in it. And so either using a wettable or lime sulfur product in the fall, just you want to do it before the leaves drop, but wait until the leaf color is starting to show a little bit. That is, the leaves are getting ready to senesce, because that's going to trigger the mites to be ready to move back into the buds. They're coming out of those little blisters and moving into the buds. That's the prime time to hit them with a sulfur or carbaryl, which contains sulfur. Same product to seven. And then that same thing can be done in the spring on the opposite end. When the new leaves just come out, that's also a time when you can use the sulfur or the carbaryl. And so your dormant oil and things like that don't work on this mite, because they're down in the bud protected until the leaf starts to grow in the spring.
And you don't want, there are some beneficial mites.
There are
mites.
Predatory mites, yes.
And so by following this program, you're not going to be bothering
right,
them?
Right, because the predatory mites overwinter down at the base of, if it's a fruit tree or an ornamental tree, they overwinter down under the cracks and crevices under the bark scales of trees, or at the very base under kind of the duff that builds up there. And so they're leaving the trees now, soon, and they won't be there when you put on this fall treatment, and they won't yet have entered the tree when you put on that spring treatment. So this is they're not exposed to it.
Okay. Well, we only have about 11 minutes left in the program. If you'd like to get in a question or comment, we'd love to have you call 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. You can email us your question at upraccess@gmail.com, or go to Twitter and send your question to #AUGarden. I was wondering about aphids on corn. My dad says the aphids are just eating the ears all, and I've seen them on the underside. Like when you pull them off, the ears off, I'll usually will see some.
Right.
I've never seen a ton, but he says he's got so much.
Just
that
has
it's,
a lot of them this
yeah.
year, and so it's damaging the ear development as well. Is that what he's noticing?
Apparently.
Yeah, so, you know, I can just say maybe it's the weather conditions we've had this year, this dry heat that we've had just has been very good for them. And so for the home garden, the kind of typical things we do for aphids can be effective. But with the corn, because they get right down, you know, between where the stalk
yeah.
and the leaf join, you have to, you know, kind of target your sprays for in there. But I would just start with hosing down the corn with your hose to see if that could help. And if you need something more than stepping up to an insecticidal soap or a horticultural oil. You know, for the home gardener where you don't have large acreage that you have to deal with, that those kinds of very soft approaches can often be enough to be effective. But oftentimes you don't notice this until it's, you know, pretty well advanced. We're not out there looking for those
yeah.
kind of problems, because they're not consistent ones, not ones we see very often.
What about one of our raspberry pests. Don't one of those get controlled in the fall?
Right. So the one that causes the whole cane to die back, that where it's tunneling right at that crown or the base of the plant, it's called the raspberry crown borer. And in the fall, so late September, early October is the time that's coming up here, to use a just right around the base of the plant, use an insecticide that's registered on raspberry, and there's a few of them out there, so just make sure when you go to your garden store that you look and make sure that raspberry is on the label. But just apply it as a drench right there at the base. You don't need to spray the whole canes or anything. And it has a 2-year life cycle, so the larvae are tunneling right in that crown area, and then they go deeper for the winter. So you want to do it before that happens, while they're just right there at the surface of the crown. You need to do it for at least 2 years in a row, because they do have this 2-year life cycle. And so if you've got an infestation, you need to clean it up by treating at least 2 years.
So if I have both kinds of berries, June-bearing and ever-bearing, but with the ever-bearing, I mow them down and only have the one crop, then should I even have to worry about them at all? Since
they can still, you know, attack the crown of the plant. So, yes, they're not selective to either type. They're present in both kinds of berries.
But would I still have to worry about both years? Since I'm cutting down,
yeah, but you're cutting down the plant, but the crown, the roots are still there, and so that's what they're feeding
on. So they're staying there both.
They're staying there both years. Yeah.
Okay. And then since I get this question a lot, it's kind of outside the insect realm a little bit, but there is a lot of powdery mildew.
Yes, there was a
lot
this year.
That's on squash.
Yes,
and the cucurbits, cucumbers, mm-hmm. and so forth. And I've noticed a ton of it, more so than I usually have.
Right. It's been bad this year. Powdery mildew is a disease, a fungus, that only needs a little bit of moisture. And usually that can be achieved through however you're irrigating. So sprinkler irrigation. If you are only drip or, you know, subsurface irrigating, then you're probably not going to have as much problem with this as where you sprinkler irrigate. But it only needs a little bit of moisture to help spread those spores. And then even though it dries out and it stays hot and dry for a long period of time in between, it still seemed to thrive this summer. So usually late in the year, there's not a lot you can do about it. You've already, the functionality of those leaves on your melons and cucumbers, you've already lost most of those. But you can certainly protect new leaves that are coming out by using a fungicide. So if you still have enough new growth coming on, it would be worth it to purchase a garden fungicide that's good for powdery mildew and use that. But as far as the older leaves, you're not going to regain those.
Well, and I don't typically see it in my garden until later in the year, because mm-hmm. I think it likes to have the cooler evening temperatures mm-hmm. seem to help it out quite a bit. But where I flood irrigate, I think my problem has come from my zucchini is where I'm seeing it. Mm-hmm. This zucchini plant I've got is so huge that it completely shades the area that it's growing in. And so I've got moisture coming mm-hmm. up from the soil that's
getting on those lower leaves.
This is getting on the lower leaves and causing problems. But with the zucchini, I don't mind.
Yeah, I mean,
the lower production.
How many more zucchini do you want, Brian?
Yeah,
aren't you overwhelmed with zucchini? I know I am.
this year, yep, we are. Okay, so let's move along. We've a bitter pit of apple.
Yeah, so this is a condition that's caused by a calcium imbalance or not enough calcium in the fruit. And we generally have a lot of calcium carbonate soil, so we have plenty of calcium in the soil. But what it tends to exacerbate it is when we have these, when you're irrigating, managing your irrigation, you irrigate, it's very wet, and then it dries out before, you know, very thoroughly before you put on. So you have that very big cycle swings of wet and dry. It tends to exasperate this bitter pit. And you tend to see this in apples especially. And some varieties are more susceptible than others, such as Honeycrisp is very sensitive to this. And you get these brown, kind of pithy patches or areas in the fruit that has this, and you can often see on the surface kind of a little sunken area where this occurs. And so instead of having a nice even flesh, tasty flesh, you've got these brown pithy areas in it. Spraying a foliar application of calcium during the summer can help with this, but for the home gardener, it's mostly going to be just managing your irrigation, trying to keep a more consistent amount of water. So instead of having these big swings in wet and dry, just keeping it irrigated a little more frequently, smaller amounts, that tends to decrease the problem. But some varieties like Honeycrisp are just more prone to it.
Dang, and that's one of my favorite apples.
Yeah, but if you do, we were talking before the show, if you have more clay in your soil where you have better water holding capacity, you tend to see less problems with this and those kinds of soils.
Okay, so in the last 2 minutes, talk about ticks and then what to do to discourage insects next year.
So this time of year in the spring and fall are what we call the two big tick times of year, where you have the adults that are looking to land on host to feed. It's the females that need a blood meal in order to develop her eggs. And it's the black-legged tick that we are the most concerned about here in Utah. That is the one that transmits or vectors Lyme disease. And there's been a team of entomologists here at USU led by Ryan Davis, Ricardo Ramirez, and Scott Bernhardt in the Department of Biology that have been surveying and looking at how many ticks here in Utah actually carry Lyme disease. And luckily or fortunately, it's pretty limited. There's only a few canyons that they found that really have had many ticks in them. And unfortunately for those of you in Tooele, it's out towards that way where they found the most of these black-legged ticks. But in general, no one wants ticks feeding on them. So this time of year in particular, be cautious. Use insect repellent. Make sure you're wearing long sleeves. Make sure you've got, I know it looks dorky, but tuck your pants into your socks. So that, but make sure that you're not getting ticks, access up to onto your skin. Do a thorough tick check after you've been out on a hike. And make sure that you don't have ticks on you that can then, they have to feed for a while before they can transmit the Lyme disease. So you want to make sure that you keep them from doing that.
And 30 seconds for removing plants and...
Yeah, so general fall garden tasks that are good to help reduce insect problems in your garden. When you're finished with your beans, your zucchini, etc., go ahead and pull them out. Don't be afraid to say, I've had enough zucchini, I'm done for the year. What this does is go ahead and remove that food source for the squash bug or for the Mexican bean beetle on your beans. Go ahead and compost those thoroughly in an active compost pile. Always good to till up the garden in the fall. That just disturbs the soil, any pupae and insects that are in the soil. Don't stack your firewood or equipment or boards or wooden boxes around your garden area. Those are prime overwintering habitats for garden insects. And so those kinds of steps can reduce the problems that you'll encounter next year.
Diane, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to Access Utah. Diane Alston is USU's extension entomologist, and we'll have her back again. Thanks for joining us on this edition of Access Utah.
You love them, but you're looking for a change. Don't rip out all those coneflowers. Instead, team them up with different plants for a different look in the garden. Hi, I'm Melinda Myers, horticulturist and gardening expert. Mix in a few drumstick flowering onions for added color and texture. The colors blend well as the coneflowers peek through the small allium flowers. Or add a fine textured plant like dill to soften the bold texture of the coneflower. Keep in mind, both plants readily recede. Add a splash of white to your landscape with white swan or the first double white coneflower, coconut lime. This new introduction is long blooming in the garden and long lasting in a vase. Try some of the other newer cultivars like razzmatazz with its fully double deep pink flowers. Deadhead to increase blooming power. Hot papaya is the first double orange coneflower with colorful and fragrant flowers. Combine this long bloomer with other sun-loving perennials. Check out our website for this and other gardening tips.
Support for Utah Public Radio is provided by the Cache Valley Center for the Arts, celebrating 20 years this season with the high-flying vocal quartet, the Manhattan Transfer, crossing jazz, fusion, pop, and a cappella, September 21st at 7:30. Ticket information is at elleneccles.org.
This is KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan. This is UPR.